Don't worry, there will be better days than these, though maybe not for you and me, but better days will come. We will bring them closer with our little eyes, with every song of freedom in the shadows of these jails. Keep on singing for the moon. Keep on singing for the moon. So don't worry, the truth is as it always is. No matter what the money says, you ain't the only voice there is. Singing, singing for the souls that caught, though they shut songs up in stadiums. Someone always carries on. Keep on singing for the moon. Keep on singing for the moon. So don't worry, the generals are just uniforms that suffer from insomnia. They don't know how to dream. Sweet dreamer, maybe your dreams don't all come true. Well, they're only dreams, they never do. But look how far we've come. Keep on singing for the moon. Keep on singing for the moon. Keep on singing for the moon. Keep on. Better days than these.
That was Rob Johnson with Singing for the Moon.
The CIA is pushing crack in the ghettos of LA, while the food crops in Colombia get sprayed by the DEA. The FBI is reading your email with something called the carnivore. While the rich are getting richer and the poor are staying poor, they're launching nuclear-powered ships up into space. One little accident could wipe out half the human race. They're putting radioactive waste into your silverware, or maybe your toaster, or perhaps your wheelchair. The Air Force is bombing Iraq every other day. They don't like the government, so the children have to pay. And the ozone hole is growing, the sheep are going blind, while the U.S. spends more on arms than the rest of the world combined. Journalists are getting fired from San Jose to Atlanta when they write about reality, not a fluff piece for Fanta. A death threat every week, and sometimes life is short when the truth is too dangerous for someone to report. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? The cancer rates are skyrocketing, though people are smoking less. If you live near a nuke, your life is bound to be a mess. Clean water's almost gone all over the earth, and what's left they want to privatize and see how much it's worth. Chevron is gunning down the students of Nigeria, turning the land to waste while the babies die of diphtheria. And the temperatures are rising, the world's forests are on fire. Pretty soon Brazil will be one raging funeral pyre. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? One in three adult Americans cannot read or write, and their children go to bed hungry every night. 2 million U.S. citizens are rotting behind bars, and while they're there, they're working hard building parts for cars. The army's running torture schools to keep the earth under control, and they're relocating Navajos so they can mine some extra coal. Our taxes pay McDonald's to sell tumors in Shanghai, while 100,000 poison vets are just about to die. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? And the people are resisting wherever you may go, and this is the single biggest fact they don't want you to know. From New Delhi to New Mexico, there are battles going on, and the darkest hour is just before the dawn. In Berkeley and New York, they're raiding radio stations, trying to turn the voice of the people into the voice of the corporations. Will we seize the airwaves, wipe the sweat off of our brow, stand and face the beast and shout democracy now? Who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? That we're living in these times? That we're living in these times.
That was David Rovics with Who Will Tell the People. We would now like to share with you some reporting and commentary by folks here at Making Waves. We're starting with a report on Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Coming to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, written and read by Amy Antonucci. This past Tuesday, May 3rd, 2005, a night of music and presentations celebrating independent media and challenging corporate control of information was presented in Portsmouth. Amy Goodman, the internationally acclaimed journalist and host of the national daily radio TV program Democracy Now!, was the featured speaker. More than 400 people packed South Church for this event, part of Democracy Now!'s Unembed the Media tour with Amy Goodman's first book, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them. The book is co-authored by her brother, David Goodman, who also spoke. The evening started with a brief introduction of each of the sponsoring groups of the event. Seacoast Peace Response organized the event with co-sponsorship by the Seacoast Alliance for Democracy, WSCA 106.1 LPFM Portsmouth Community Radio, Grassroots New Hampshire, New Hampshire Peace Action, Democracy for New Hampshire, Sauhegan Valley, Lakes Region Peace and Justice Group, WMD, Women Making a Difference, and WXGR 101.5 LPFM Dover. Singer-songwriter David Rovics was welcomed back to Portsmouth to play a short set of his powerful music. The Democracy Now! Crew then took the stage. After showing selections from Independent Media in a Time of War, an Independent Media Center video featuring Amy, David Goodman was the first to speak. David is an investigative journalist, regularly contributing to such periodicals as Mother Jones and The Nation, who lives nearby in Vermont. Like his sister, he is an impressive speaker with much knowledge and insight into the current state of the media in the U.S. Amy Goodman was last to speak and delivered an impassioned, informed, and inspiring speech. She shared stories of reporting from East Timor, where she witnessed and was almost killed in a massacre perpetrated by the Indonesian government using U.S.-made weaponry. She told the laughter-prompting story of her appearance on the Sally Jesse Raphael show. She spoke of the many journalists already killed covering the Iraq War and criticized the embedded journalism program. She spoke often of a concept she discusses in her book as well. Quote, "Going to where the silence is, that is the responsibility of a journalist. Giving a voice to those who have been forgotten, forsaken, and beaten down by the powerful. It is the best reason I know to carry our pens, cameras, and microphones into our communities and out into the wider world." The evening concluded with an update from George Corrett from Grassroots New Hampshire on the campaign to bring Democracy Now! To New Hampshire Public Radio. Following her talk, people had the opportunity to meet Amy as she did book signings before driving back to New York that night to be ready the next day to produce the next episode of Democracy Now! Thanks to everyone who came out this past Tuesday evening to hear Amy Goodman speak. For those of you unable to make it or anxious to hear her another time, we hope to get a hold of the recording done that night to play on an upcoming Making Waves episode. You can also hear Amy on Democracy Now! Every weekday on WSCALP 106.1 FM, which you are listening to now, from 5 to 6 p.m., or on WXGR 101.5 LPFM Dover at noon. You can also listen on the web. Go to www.democracynow.org.
Next, we have a piece called Recycled Villains by me, Steve Diamond, and it's posted on NHIMC. First, we have John Negroponte, whose deft and blind organizing of terrorists to destabilize the democratically elected government of Nicaragua in the 1980s earned him the credentials to become the top U.S. official in Iraq, leading the quest for democracy and quelling the so-called terrorists. John Bolton, the irreverent alleged diplomat who has said, quote, "There is no such thing as the United Nations," and that, quote, "If the UN Secretary building in New York lost 10 stories, it wouldn't make a difference," has been selected to be ambassador to the UN. Preferring yes-men to the truth, Bolton has attempted to fire a senior intelligence officer who wouldn't agree that Cuba has a biological weapons program. Nepotism over merit is another recurring theme of the Bush administration. Bush spokesperson Scott McClellan had apparently taken his irony shots when he asserted that the popular Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr ought not to be taken seriously as a leader, since he was, quote, just basically trading on his father's popularity and political record. Bush also appointed Michael Fleischer to restructure Iraq's economy, who got his job through his brother, former White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer. Michael Fleischer stated in the Chicago Tribune that, quote, the only paradigm the Iraqi people know is cronyism. We are teaching them that there is an alternative system. Terrorism for freedom is another unusual concept given currency by President Bush. According to several former intelligence officials interviewed by the New York Times, the political group funded by the CIA and run by interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi in the 1990s, quote, used car bombs and other explosive devices smuggled into Iraq in an attempt to destabilize Saddam Hussein's regime. How quickly the doors of power revolve for brutal CIA agents seeking power, including Saddam Hussein himself. When Alawi is no longer useful, he too will be disposed of. And now we've finally reached the pinnacle of short attention span politics. Ahmed Chalabi has been declared Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq. This absurdly distinguished character was originally hand-picked by the Bush administration to become the new puppet leader of Iraq, yet was soundly defeated in the recent elections. He was also recently arrested by U.S. soldiers and accused of being an Iranian agent. Regardless, Chalabi is an interesting pick to control Iraq's vast oil wealth, given the 22-year prison sentence he faces in Jordan for embezzlement, theft, and misuse of depositor funds. Chalabi's nephew has also been installed as the finance minister of Iraq. Apparently, supplying false intelligence about WMD in Iraq before the 2003 invasion is a sort of favor that guarantees reward. Such good works may well have helped former CIA Director George Tenet earn the Presidential Medal of Freedom as well. As always, the villains get reused while the victims are all brand new. It takes a truly rare caliber of character to do Bush's dirty work, somewhere between George Nelson and Charles Manson. And there are many citations used in this story, about 10. You can check those out at the IMC article, nhindymedia.org. Search for Recycled Villains.
With Mother's Day coming tomorrow, we are sharing with you this excerpt from Geoff Parrish's article on the anti-war origins of Mother's Day. This was published on workingforchange.com on May 6, 2004. This year, as more and more mothers in America, as well as Iraq, mourn their fallen sons and daughters, lost to the insanity of organized violence, Julia Ward Howe's call for women to not allow their men to constantly play at war is suddenly back in fashion. Around the country, her original Mother's Day proclamation will be the basis for parades, remembrances, and other events that try to reclaim the holiday's original spirit in a year when the United States male-dominated government talks seriously not of avoiding war, but staying the course on the multiple ones we're already fighting. The radical origins of Mother's Day, as a powerful feminist call against war, penned in the wake of the U.S. Civil War in 1870, are fully compatible with the universal notion of honoring mothers. Women, even more so now, are the primary sufferers of warfare. In the 20th century, civilian populations bore 90% of war's casualties around the world. Mass and indiscriminate attacks popularized in World War II by the Holocaust, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Allied firebombings in Japan and Germany, and the rape of Nanjing are only the most spectacular examples of a phenomenon in which women become the rape and famine victims, the refugees, the forgotten statistics, and what are invariably the wars of men. Here is the original pre-Hallmark Mother's Day proclamation penned in Boston by Julia Ward Howe in 1870. Arise, then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts, whether your baptism be that of water or of tears. Say firmly, We will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands shall not come to us reeking of carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We women of one country will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, "Disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil in the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them solemnly take counsel with each other as to the means whereby the great human family can live in peace, each bearing after his own time the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God. In the name of womanhood and humanity, I earnestly ask that a general congress of women without limit of nationality may be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient and at the earliest period consistent with its objectives, to promote the alliance of the different nationalities, the amicable settlement of international questions, the great and general interests of peace." That's a call that seems to be needed now as much as it was in 1870.
Masters of war, replace my songbird. Beat back the life in hands lying still. Call forth the dance in bodies now broken. You promised peace, what call you this? I am a woman, I've come through the ages, bearing the water and bearing the babes. Little I've owned, not even my body. I've lived my whole life by laws I've not made. Some say my hands were meant for holding sons of the warriors till they too must leave. Then hold the flags laid o'er their young corpses, and last hold my own head bent out to grieve. These are the hands kneading rage into justice. These are the hands taking back stolen land. These are the hands of proud women rising. This is my story, and these are my hands.
That was Femme Ami, a New Hampshire women's a cappella group, with Song of Hands. Yesterday in Greenland, New Hampshire, Senator Gregg received an award from some environmentalists, while others were outside the proceedings protesting. This report was filed by Jeff White with Making Waves.
This is Jeff White from Making Waves, and I'm here in Greenland. Senator Judd Gregg is giving some kind of a spiel. I'm going to talk to a few people that are here holding signs.
As we approached him, we stayed out of the way. We did not disrupt in any way. As you can see, we stayed out in the field. And as he passed by us after it was over, I said, "We're very disappointed in you, Senator." And he said, "Not half as disappointed as I am in you."
Oh,
and then Bob shouted out to him, "Shame on you for Anwar." And I said, shame on NBTE. And that was the end of it. He just walked away, but it's totally...
He's ashamed. He's disappointed in you for what? Like?
Oh, for actually probably caring about the environment. So that's probably what upset him so much. I also pointed out that I know that more than half of his PAC money comes from out of New Hampshire, and that he should be representing us.
I love this country, and I love being an American, but living with this administration is becoming embarrassing because most of my relatives don't live in this country, and I get phone calls all the time saying, what is happening in that country? What's going on? Why aren't you doing something? And how much can we do? Because it's disgraceful what this administration has done to us.
Is there a particular issue that Senator Gregg has really disappointed you on?
For the environment.
Okay.
Alaska.
Yep. Okay, so he's here now. It's kind of ironic because he's here because he protected some land here. Is that correct?
He helped protect some land. He protected some land.
Right, so got some funding.
Yes.
Okay.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah.
However, it isn't just local. This has to be a national issue. And this country isn't doing enough. It's all about oil and about drilling and about clear cutting and about taking all the trees. And we're destroying Mother Nature. And pretty soon that will destroy us.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think we're destroying Mother Nature?
What's... You take down all the trees.
But why?
We have
why?
No leaves.
Why?
For money.
For money, yeah.
For money. We little guys, the working class, mm-hmm. no longer seems to have a voice, and that's the sad part. We need a voice. What I saw were Democrats on the floor of the Senate putting through amendments to try to save those most vulnerable being hurt by this bill, and that would be people who maybe perhaps have a lot of medical bills and are bankrupt because of a lot of medical bills. I also saw Democrats putting forth amendments for soldiers, people in our military that have hit hard times. Perhaps they could have been exempt from this bill. And each one of them I saw defeated. So this bill I believe to be a very cruel bill. And I would like an answer as to why the Republicans did not at least vote in favor of some of these amendments that would help those people that would be most hurt and are most vulnerable from this bankruptcy bill.
And Senator Gregg voted for that bill.
Yes, he did.
He did. A person here has a sign with real ID crossed out, and so I wanted to ask her about that. Can you tell me why you're here?
And I'm here for a number of reasons, but one very important one is that the Real ID is the beginnings of a national ID card, and that most despots have started that way. But it's worrisome because when you study history, Chairman Mao did a similar thing early on in order to consolidate his power and have control of the people. And so a national ID is something that a free country really should not do.
How do you guys feel about the funding for Homeland Security? These are local police officers.
I think it's been... The funding's been nice.
There has been an increase in funding.
There's been the opportunity to pick up some different items that are needed. Sometimes how the money's funneled and where it's funneled, I question. But overall, I think it's a good thing.
All right.
Do you think it would be better to spend more money here at home to actually secure our borders than to send billions of dollars to Iraq? This is no names, curious from a law officer's point of view. Not to say we should just abandon Iraq, but do you think that some of that money could be better spent at home, I guess?
I guess that's a tough issue to address here.
Mm.
My problem with Iraq isn't that we're there. It's how we're there and what I feel is a lack of a plan. So I, to send all those people there and not really know how we're going to do these things, that is an issue for me. I don't want to sit there and say it's absolutely bad, it's wrong. I just would have liked a better plan.
for us. Or a plan, right?
Well, yeah, I guess. Or maybe if they had a plan, they didn't share it with the rest of us.
Yeah, well, they did. They made that.
And I understand that some of these things are kind of on the fly, but you got to have a. When you're investing that many people.
Have you read a Mother Jones article? It's a fairly recent issue, and it said that it interviewed this kid who started Veterans Against the War, and he said that one of the first things that happened to him when he went to Iraq was his superior officer said, "We're not here for the reason you think we're here. We're here for oil." And he said he appreciated the truthfulness of his superior officer, but decided that was the wrong reason to be there.
First thing they did is they went and guarded the oil.
This is the most pernicious administration, certainly in your lifetime, but in mine and in my mother's.
They're making Nixon look honest, this administration.
I mean,
they're just doing it all to the back door.
Okay, what Bush did was redefine the definition of wetland. So if it doesn't have a ship on it, if it's not in navigable water, doesn't get protection. So that opened up 20 million acres to development.
Also opened up our national forest to road building.
He redefined the definition of mercury. Mercury was is known to be a potent neurotoxin. Well, he made it something else, just with the stroke of a pen.
Yeah. I mean, he's so much for the culture of life.
Yeah, I mean, so much
protecting the unborn baby. That's what it's kind of ironic because mercury. If my wife's pregnant, she can't eat tuna or swordfish or anything because it's poisonous to the fetus. And so if they're so pro-life, then where's the policies? Not just on the environment, but...
We represent a number of organizations, but we're former DENIAC, most of us.
Yeah, it's pretty
good deal. Yeah.
You know the whole thing with Iraq, the insurgents? They used to be called the resistance. They went and told all the media, you can't call them resistance anymore, you have to call them insurgents.
Right.
Literally, overnight, there was a mandate passed out by the Bush administration saying, just like they won't show flag red coffins, it's all being censored.
You know, the Germans did the same thing. They explained everything away. Everything they did was legal, even if it wasn't. I have no doubts that our country is under siege. By corporations, and that the vacuum of a world without the protection of the Constitution will be filled by powerful corporations and will become enslaved, and such things as minimum wage and the 40-hour work week will be in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
This administration has the ability to set this country back 50 years. And from an environmental point of view, it set it back 20 already.
So are there other issues that you're concerned about, particularly with Senator Gregg here?
There are so many issues. The objective on the part of this administration seems to be adding riders to bills so that public discussion is extinguished. And we're going to find that to be the case with the location of oil refineries and nuclear power plants. They're just going to suddenly pop up across the country, and the public will have no input, no means of preventing it. The groundwork was partially laid by the Reagan administration back in the 80s to take public participation out of the process.
Mm-hmm.
But this administration will go far beyond what Reagan did.
Next, for some excerpts from Between the Lines, independent radio out of Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marcus Raskin, longtime peace and justice activist and co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses today's peace movement opposing the U.S. war and occupation of Iraq. Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, who examines the intensifying global struggle to capture petroleum resources. And Wade Henderson, executive director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, who takes a critical look at the consequences of the Republican Party's likely attempt to abolish the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. With the recent escalation of violence by insurgents in Iraq that includes daily attacks on U.S. and Iraqi forces, car bombings, and kidnappings, the optimistic picture recently painted by the White House and Pentagon officials of diminishing violence, stability, and a short-term reduction in the number of American occupation troops seems ever more implausible. Meanwhile, nations such as Italy and the Ukraine that had initially deployed soldiers to support the Bush administration's occupation of Iraq are now steadily withdrawing. While differences outnumber similarities between the Iraq War and the U.S. war in Vietnam, there are a growing number of observers who are concerned that the Bush administration may be making the same critical mistakes that led to the American defeat and withdrawal from South Vietnam 30 years ago. Critics and supporters of Washington's war in Southeast Asia, haunted by the deaths of 58,000 American troops and more than a million Vietnamese, have drawn very different lessons from the Vietnam conflict. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Marcus Raskin, co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies in 1963 and a vocal opponent of the Vietnam War and military draft. Raskin assesses the current peace movement's demand for a rapid U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and the lessons he believes should have been learned in Vietnam.
Well, I think that if you look at the Vietnam War, there was an election in September of 1967 in South Vietnam. And the assumption in the press and among people in the administration was, you see, this election is working, and it will result in the stabilization of the South Vietnamese government, and everything is going to be hunky-dory. The same sort of crude understanding of life of another culture is happening in Iraq. There's nothing to suggest, at least at this point, and there's nothing on the horizon to suggest that the attempt to have an election or an election on top of what is now an incipient civil war, that it will result in any sort of quiet and allowing the United States to leave. Furthermore, though, there is in this case no apparent reason that the United States will leave. It wants to have the bases in the Middle East. It wants to be the nation that is able to guide where the oil is supposed to go, etc. And it wants to establish itself directly as the nation that has a sphere of influence over that area.
By all accounts, military recruitment is down, and there are real prospects out there that a draft may be established, reestablished in this country soon. What do you think the response of the peace movement, who want a quick withdrawal of U.S. troops from the occupation of Iraq, what do you think the peace movement should be doing now?
I think that there are several things that should go on. One is obviously the increase of marches and demonstrations, which I think does have an effect. I think also there is a whole question of legitimacy of the war. That is to say, it's based on a lie. There are no weapons of mass destruction, on and on, that the president had no intention of following whatever the intelligence said, that he and Blair wanted to make war and had planned to do this several years ago, so that this was an aggressive war, that being an aggressive war, it's something which is violative of the Nuremberg principles, which the United States supported as it related to the German war criminals. Furthermore, and that's just a part of an argument, furthermore, it strikes me as mistaken in the extreme not to raise the question of either censure or impeachment with regard to the president and his cabinet, and at least the president, in order to make clear that these people indeed have acted in an unlawful way.
Just a final question, if I could. Many half-truths and blatant lies were told in justifying the Iraq war on the part of the Bush administration, but our government seems unaccountable for these breaches of trust. In fact, policymakers have been rewarded with promotions and medals and re-election. The press was blamed for the loss of the Vietnam War by conservatives who supported that conflict. And it seems that the press here in the United States has been asleep at the switch, to say the least, in terms of scrutinizing and challenging the rationales for war in Iraq.
Well, I think that's right. And for the most part, our press is what you could call a palace court press. That is to say, it takes handouts and is more willing to take propaganda than doing individual or critical research on various questions. And it's a great shame, because what that means is that the people of this country suffer as a result of it. This issue is going to become more and more important as people, in any case, move away from reading newspapers and dependent on mass media such as television, which indeed only tells a fleeting glimpse of any story. So the country is faced with a very, very great problem now in terms of how news is gathered, how criticism is made, and how it gets out.
Any lessons you want to impart from what you learned during the Vietnam War and your activism against that conflict?
I think that there's one principle, and that it's less a principle, I think, than a stance, and that is that unless you speak out and act, the social and political space will close down. The only way to keep open that social and political space is to use it.
That was Marcus Raskin, longtime peace activist and co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. Raskin, along with Carl Lavin, are the editors of a new book titled In Democracy's Shadow, The Secret World of National Security. Michael Clare, professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, is one of the foremost experts on the politics of oil. He has written widely on the subject, with his most recent book, Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Dependency on Imported Oil, addressing the intensifying international struggle to capture petroleum resources. Professor Clare was the keynote speaker at a Yale University conference on global oil frontiers on April 29th. His topic was Petroleum Flows and Political Conflict, in which he addressed three topics: the shortfall between demand and supply and increased competition for the oil that remains, the historic shift in world oil production from the global north to the global south, and the increasing militarization of national policies to protect countries' access to oil. Here we present an excerpt of Professor Clare's speech.
The Department of Energy assumes that the global demand for petroleum will continue to rise at a very high level over the coming 20 years. That's as far as their predictions go at present, out to 2025. This is true because of continuing high demand for petroleum in the United States, which uses one-fourth of all the world's oil on a daily basis and is expected to continue to do so for as far as we could see into the future. Most of our oil is used for transportation, especially ground transportation, especially private vehicles, but also for airplanes and ships and diesel trains and the like. And Americans are driving more all the time. They're driving less and less fuel-efficient vehicles over the past decade. At present, the developing countries use only one-third of world oil, but in 2025, they're expected to use half of world oil at a much higher level. So the Department of Energy, combining rising demand in the developing world and steady demand in the industrial countries predicts that world oil demand will increase by 50%, a huge amount, between 2000 and 2025. This is going to be a Herculean task for the world's oil industry, costing trillions of dollars and requiring heroic efforts of exploration and development. The fact that no new vast discoveries have been made on the scale of the oil fields found in the 1950s and 1960s since then suggest that it's highly unrealistic that the world oil industry is going to be able to match the anticipated demand. And this is going to pit the oil-consuming countries against one another in fierce competition for the available supplies, fierce competition. This will lead to economic pressures, economic competition, which we see now with higher prices, but I fear it's also going to lead to political pressures and risk-taking behavior. Now, that's the first factor that I wanted to mention. Now, couple this with the second aspect of the problem that troubles me, and that is this historic shift from the global north to the global south and the location of the remaining supply of oil. As recently as 1950, two-thirds of the world's oil came from the global north, from those countries, and only a third from the developing world. But now it's exactly the other way around. All of the fields in the global north are in decline or at a peak production and are about to decline, and there's very little prospect of new oil coming on stream in the developed parts of the world. Almost all of the large untapped fields are in the global south, in the Middle East, in Africa, in Latin America, and in the Caspian Sea Basin. The problem here is that almost all of these countries are fundamentally unstable or corrupt or authoritarian or live in dangerous neighborhoods or are subject to civil wars or separatist conflicts or border disputes or house anti-American terrorists or insurgents of one sort. All of them are prone to instability. And this is not a coincidence. It's a product of partly of their imperial past. All of these countries, or most of them, were under the control of the imperial powers at one time or another. U.S. troops are now helping to guard the pipeline from the Caspian, the BTC pipeline in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. There are American troops in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. We're building bases in Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan. All of this supposedly part of the war against terror, but if you read the congressional requests for appropriations, you find what they mean by anti-terrorism is protecting oil wells and oil pipelines and oil loading facilities in the Caspian Sea. The war against terror has become a war to protect America's foreign oil interests. I truly believe that the issues of oil will now become the decisive issues in the lives of everyone on the planet. Freeing ourselves from the addiction to cheap oil is the most pressing moral and political and economic and environmental issue of our time.
That was Michael Clare, professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. Call the study program at area code 413-559-5367. Or visit their website at pawss.hampshire.edu. Professor Clare's talk was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. As the likelihood that the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate will soon use extraordinary parliamentary maneuvers to eliminate the filibuster, the Democratic minority's only tool to block lifetime judicial appointments they view as extremist, TV ads from groups on both sides of the issue are hitting the airwaves. The GOP idea of abolishing the filibuster, a Senate institution for over 200 years, has infuriated Senate Democrats and led them to threaten non-cooperation in future legislative matters if the so-called nuclear option is approved. Senate Democrats used the filibuster to block 10 of President Bush's 45 nominees to federal appeals courts during his first term. Since being reelected, Mr. Bush has now renominated 7 of those nominees, including Judges Priscilla Owen and Janice Rogers Brown. At stake is not only the current appointments to federal appeals courts, but the U.S. Supreme Court, where at least one vacancy is expected in the coming year. As this fight heats up, a Washington Post ABC News poll recently found that a majority of Americans, by a 2-to-1 margin, oppose the GOP plan to eliminate the filibuster. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wade Henderson, executive director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, part of a coalition of groups working to prevent a filibuster rules change. Henderson takes a critical look at President Bush's nominees and the consequences he sees of abolishing the Senate filibuster.
Let me say at the outset that the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights is the nation's premier civil and human rights coalition. We have over 185 national organizations working together to support the advancement of civil and human rights. Our coalition is opposed to Senator Frist's proposal of the so-called nuclear option, which is a procedural change of Senate rules that would make it possible for a simple majority of 51 senators to literally confirm any nominee, either judicial or executive branch nominee, who is put before the Senate without regard to qualifications on a simple party line vote. It does not limit, however, the rule change to nominations alone. It would also allow legislation to be approved with a simple majority vote, thus changing a Senate procedural rule that's been in place for over 200 years. Now, when the founders of our own representative democracy got together to establish our tripartite system of government, they created, of course, an executive branch, a legislative branch, and a judicial branch. What we're talking about here are the confirmation of federal judicial nominees to a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court and or lower courts. And what this rule change would do is make it possible for a president to nominate someone as out of the mainstream as one could imagine and still have that individual confirmed to this lifetime appointment on the court by a simple majority of 51 senators. Because Republicans in the Senate now number 55 votes with 44 Democrats and one independent, even if Republicans voted exclusively along party lines, they would guarantee the confirmation of every nominee. Now, currently, this debate is really not what I think most Americans understand it to be. That is to say, the president has nominated about 215 appointees to the federal courts, of whom 205 have been confirmed. In other words, over 96% of President Bush's nominees to the federal court have been confirmed. The Senate has blocked about 10 of these nominees. And the 10 nominees that have been blocked are among the most out of the mainstream, the most extremely conservative ideologues who often shape their own views of the court in substitute for precedents established by higher courts in their own jurisdiction.
Wade Henderson, what do you think the motivation here is of the Republican Party to take this historic and unprecedented action? They talk about discrimination against judges who hold Christian beliefs and that somehow this is bias against people of religion. What is your thoughts on what motivates all this?
Well, first of all, I think the accusation that members of the Senate, either Democrat or Republican, are engaging in some form of religious bias, that is bias against religiously motivated individuals, is really a red herring. And I think it's a slanderous charge against senators from either party. I think most senators are really thoughtful. They're analytical. They take the nomination of individuals to high office very seriously. They don't engage in that kind of blatant discrimination that I think most Americans would agree is abhorrent. We're a country based on Judeo-Christian values. Nonetheless, we are a country that has a broad tolerance for religious views. If you're Jewish, if you're Christian, if you're Muslim, if you have no religion, we have respect for your views, even though we may hold a different view. And I think to suggest that senators are somehow engaging in discrimination because they question the suitability of an individual for high office not because of that individual's religious beliefs, but rather because of policy positions taken by that individual in the offices which he or she already holds, does seem to me is a terrible slander.
The focus has been on religion, as you just talked about, but what are your concerns about some of these more extremist judicial nominees that may get through if the nuclear option is carried out on the topic of civil rights, of affirmative action, yeah, and many other concerns that I know you work on?
Well, I'm very concerned. I mean, I know, for example, that two of the nominees who have been invoked by Senator Frist and used to gain sympathetic views about his proposal to change Senate rules have been Janice Rogers Brown, an African-American Supreme Court justice from California who has been nominated for a seat on the powerful D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and a woman named Priscilla Owen, who is a federal district court judge in Texas who has been nominated for a seat on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the highest court governing the states of Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. And each of those individuals, because they are women, in one instance an African-American woman, and because they have very sympathetic personal stories of achievement, somehow that's being used as a substitute for evaluating the individual records of these women and the way in which they have engaged in decisions on the court. Janice Rogers Brown, for example, is really widely recognized as one of the most virulent ideologues on the California bench. In one case, she came down against 17 Hispanic workers who endured years of their boss hurling racial slurs at them in the workplace. And somehow she argued that racial slurs were a form of protected free speech, certainly not in the workplace. And, you know, that was a case of actual harassment on the job. And that decision was, in fact, vindicated for the plaintiffs in this case. In the case of Priscilla Owen, she has a hard-earned reputation of siding with corporate interests over the interests of everyday Americans. I mean, in one of her cases, a 14-year-old boy was rendered a quadriplegic after a seatbelt malfunction, and he was in a car accident. And Owen said on his case, even though both sides had requested prompt action, the auto company wanted action because it wanted to reverse a lower court judgment. And the young boy's family wanted action because it desperately needed the money for his child care. Unfortunately, Owen said on the case, too long, the young man died while awaiting a new trial. And, you know, from our perspective, these are just really, I think, examples of a more strident ideological bent that really is inappropriately rewarded with appointment to higher office. Both of these women serve as judges now. Both of them are in positions of responsibility in their respective states. And yet elevating them to positions on two of the most powerful courts in the country seems to be a perverse reward for not having given the due diligence that most Americans think is just an ordinary part of being a judge in our country.
That was Wade Henderson, Executive Director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. Contact the group by calling area code 202-466-3311 or visit their website at www.civilrights.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio.
The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to let us know what you think of our show. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be featuring interviews with New Hampshire Peace Action Director Ann Miller, who just returned from a peace delegation to Iran, and from local activist Michael Murray, who just returned from a conference on fair trade in Cuba. We leave you with this quote by Martin Luther King. Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter.